Welcome to the Regulatory Transparency Project's fourth branch podcast series. All expressions of opinion are those of the speaker.
Hello, and welcome to this Regulatory Transparency Project podcast. My name is Kayla Kleist, and I'm an assistant director of the Regulatory Transparency Project here at the Federalist Society. Today, on this fourth branch podcast, we're delighted to host Professor David Bernstein for a discussion on the Office of Management and Budget, or OMB's, classification structure on race and ethnicity. Professor Bernstein, thank you so much for being with us today. We appreciate you taking the time.
Thank you so much for having me.
For our audience, Professor Bernstein is Professor of Law and Executive Director of the Liberty and Law Center at the Antonin Scalia Law School at George Mason University, where he's been teaching since 1995. He also has been a visiting professor at the University of Michigan, Georgetown University, William & Mary, Brooklyn Law School, the University of Turin, and Hebrew University. Professor Bernstein teaches constitutional law, evidence, and products liability, and is the author of at least five books, one of which is Classified, The Untold Story of Racial Classification in America. He's also the co-author of two additional books. In addition to his books, he's written dozens of articles and essays published in major law reviews, including the California Law Review, Columbia Law Review, Michigan Law Review, and Yale Law Journal. Now, while there's certainly more I could say in the interest of time, I'll cut my introduction there. Though, if our audience would like to know more about Professor Bernstein, please feel free to visit regproject.org and read his impressive full bio. With that, however, we can turn to our discussion. Starting at the beginning, why is the government in the business of classifying race?
The government, I mean, obviously, we can go back in American history and say that starting with the first census, the government classified people by whether they're white or of African descent. But the federal government in particular didn't really otherwise classify people except for purposes of immigration law until fairly recently. And what really happened was that in the 1950s, the government started to try to enforce executive orders against government contractors, requiring them to adhere to anti-discrimination rules. The obvious problem is if you don't know whether the employer, let's say a defense contractor, is hiring minorities and whatnot, well, how do you know if they're complying? So they started asking the government contractors to identify people by various racial categories and other categories initially, and then to report their statistics. Eventually, as the Civil Rights Revolution went on, and we had lots of civil rights legislation again to make sure that those laws could be enforced and see what progress different groups were making, the government had to create sort of consistent classifications. And they eventually did in the 1970s come up with standardized classifications to try to make them uniform throughout the government. So if they're getting data from different agencies, they could compare them apples to apples.
Got it. That makes sense for why we'd have sort of this broad classification structure. You may have gotten into this a little bit. Why in the sort of various agencies that could have given those defined set of structures, was it that the Office of Management and Budget was the one that ended up setting these definitions?
Well, so what happened was that really the story goes like this. Caspar Weinberger, later defense secretary under President Reagan, most famous for that, but he was the Secretary of Health and Human Services under the Nixon administration. And people came to him and said, look, we have this problem. In particular, we're trying to figure out, under a lot of congressional pressure, figure out what's going on with the Spanish-speaking origin population in the United States, mostly Mexican-Americans, but of course there at the time were a fair number of Puerto Rican-Americans in the mainland and Cuban-Americans and smaller groups as well. And it turns out that we're not getting good data because different agencies are defining the group in different ways. I think I've counted like 13 different ways that agencies were counting this group, ranging from Chicano, which is really mixed race Mexican Americans, to some broad category like Latinos and sort of everything in between. Some people include Puerto Ricans and Cubans. Some only included Puerto Ricans. Some included anyone of Spanish-speaking origin, Spanish language, Spanish surname, you name it. So Weinberger asked an interagency task force to get together and figure out what do we do, not just for the limited groups that are coming to me with specific issues, but we might as well do it throughout the whole government. And because it was an interagency commission that was charged with doing this. There was no one agency that had control over it. So I don't know exactly how OMB got involved, but I guess the idea is that OMB is sort of in charge of making government-wide rules and recommendations that involve statistics and so forth, and money. And there's a lot of money that flows depending on, you know, minority-serving institutions and other things. So OMB wound up with being in charge of ultimately writing the formal regulations and putting them into the Federal Register.
Got it. Okay, that makes some sense. But it came from sort of an interagency task force and now is under OMB. Turning then to sort of the structure that we have, what OMB has promulgated, I think there are two distinct categories, and you can correct me if I'm wrong. We have races and an ethnicity, multiple ethnicities, that are these categories promulgated by the OMB. How did we come to have that structure? You mentioned a little bit it was this interagency task force. And then what's the difference legally between a race and ethnicity?
So we have this very bizarre, I would say, situation in which the government does in fact classify people first by ethnicity and then by race. So you might think to yourself, if you hear that, well, I am ethnically Italian American, but no one ever asked me to check that off. So ethnicity is actually solely Hispanic, not Hispanic. That's the only ethnicity that's recognized. The origins of this, we'll go back again to the 1950s when the government was first figuring out how to classify people for these executive orders. And initially, everyone understood that a primary group that we were interested in were African Americans, or in those days they would have been referred to as Negro Americans, but they weren't really clear on who else we wanted to count. So they initially asked about Jews and sometimes about Catholics. But the underlying problem was that in those days, it was considered extremely rude. And in some states, like California, it was actually illegal to ask someone, what is your ethnicity or religion? So in practice, plus African-American civil rights groups said, yeah, we really should be focusing on race. So between those two factors, basically what you would do if you were the HR person at Raytheon or some other defense contractor, you look around the room and say, well, people look black, okay. And the one drop rule says, if you look black, right, so you're black. We could look around. We wouldn't know if you're Hispanic, but we could say you, quote unquote, look Mexican. You look Asian. So it turned out that we only wound up with those particular groups. So we didn't really have a Hispanic classification. We had in practice a classification of people who looked Hispanic. By the early 1970s, though, things had shifted, and civil rights groups and the ACLU, which had formerly been very much against asking people to identify themselves by race or ethnicity, were now in favor of doing so. And if you ask people, are you of a Spanish-speaking origin, it's not whether you look Hispanic or don't look Hispanic, whatever that might mean to you. It's just whether you're of any Spanish-speaking origin. You could be blonde hair and blue-eyed. You could be of Afro-Hispanic descent or whatever, Afro-Cuban descent, for example, and you're still Hispanic. Meanwhile, the Nixon administration was very keen on expanding out from people who, quote-unquote, groups that, quote-unquote, looked Hispanic, like Chicanos or many Puerto Ricans, into having a broader pan-ethnic classification for two reasons. First of all, Nixon thought there was a lot of radicalism going on among Chicano activists, Puerto Rican activists. There was a lot of Puerto Rican terrorism, which we've kind of forgotten about in favor of independence. So if we have a broad Spanish-speaking origin, that would be a Middle American classification. There's no Hispanic in Latin America. Based on Latin America, if they're Hispanic, they don't know what you're talking about, really. They're Mexican or Argentine or whatever. So number two, when affirmative action was starting up in the early 70s, Nixon said, wait a second, we're giving preferences to Mexican Americans and Puerto Ricans, but not to Cubans? That's not right. Cubans vote for us. Now, Cubans are primarily Caucasian, self-identified as white, but they, for all those reasons, they sort of came within this new pan-Hispanic classification. And once you include white Cubans, how do you exclude white Argentines or white Spaniards? So we have all that background. We also have a congressman named Roybal who gets Congress to pass legislation saying the government has to figure out how to classify people by Spanish-speaking origin. And this interagency commission that I mentioned gets together, has a specific subcommittee composed of three volunteers, one Cuban-American, one Puerto Rican, one Mexican-American, to figure out what to call this classification. And they decide on Hispanic, and they say it's anyone of Spanish-speaking cultural origin. Okay, so I am getting to your question. So why do we have this ethnic classification for Hispanic? Well, first of all, it's clearly not a racial classification. Again, you could be blonde hair and blue eye, 100% of European origin. You could be 100% indigenous. You could be 100% of African descent. You could be 100% of Asian ethnic descent, and so, or any combination thereof, and be Hispanic. So it would seem weird to make that a racial classification. Plus, at the time, at least, all the major Mexican-American groups, which were the primary Latino groups in the country, were against calling them a race. They thought we are an ethnicity, not a race. So therefore, we round up with Hispanic as an ethnic classification and everything else as a racial classification. And again, well, why aren't we looking at Italian Americans and Polish Americans and Irish Americans? Because the origins of the Hispanic ethnic classification were really as a Chicano racial classification.
Got it. Okay. I would love to circle back to sort of both of those together and how we use these categories. But firstly, we have one ethnic classification. How many racial classifications?
So originally we had Black / I think they called it an Afro-American. Now it's Black / African-American. We have we originally had Asian-American / Pacific Islander. Then we had Hispanic. And then we have white, and then we have Native American / American Indian. The only thing that's changed since then as far as the scope of the classifications is that Asian American Pacific Islander has been broken off into Asian American and Pacific Islander / Native Hawaiian. Those are now two distinct classifications. Hispanic is now Hispanic / Latino, but the underlying definition hasn't changed. So even though Brazilians are arguably Latinos, because they're not of Spanish cultural origin, they're not within that classification. There was a controversy briefly in the 1980s, should we include African and Caribbean immigrants in the African-American classification? The argument would be, well, even though he uses a race, African-Americans have been in this country a long time, a sort of really an ethnic group, and they're distinct from recent immigrants from Kenya or Somalia. But the OMB just kind of decided arbitrarily, really, yes, we'll call them Black African-American. We won't have a separate classification for them. So the classifications really have barely changed. Again, really the only significant change other than terminology since the 1970s is that we have a separate classification for Native Hawaiians and Pacific Islanders and no longer in the AAPI classification.
Got it. So we currently have five racial classifications and one ethnic classification. How are those used? Are they used separately? Are they used together? We have these categories. They've been set up by OMB. What do we do with them now?
Okay, so I should say that when they were first created, this was ambiguous. What do you do? Do you ask people about all of them at once, or do you ask separately about ethnicity and race? Educational institutions, which is kind of important given the recent affirmative action case in the Supreme Court, educational institutions for a good 30 years almost, or so actually, not even almost, 30 years, when they ask students to identify themselves, they use one question. Are you Black, Hispanic, white, Native American, AAPI, or later Asian Pacific Islander, Native Hawaiian? And therefore, in the education context, Hispanic came to be seen like it's the same as a racial classification. And Supreme Court did and still does refer to Hispanic as if it's a racial classification when actually it's not. But you would really have the option for until 1997, if you were asking people, you could either ask one question, which of these six classifications or five or whatever it is, are you including Hispanic? Or you could ask first, are you Hispanic ethnically? And then what is your race? And you could be Hispanic and something else. In 1997, OMB created new regulations demanding that all agencies ask only the two-part question. First, are you Hispanic? And then what race are you? The educational institutions, Department of Education, took a good decade to actually implement that. But now every agency, every institution that follows the government rules, either because they have to or just because they follow them, as the Common App has done for educational institutions, asks, are you Hispanic? And then what race are you? So you could be Hispanic and something else. That's the only group. And oh, I should say there's one other change. When you, until 1987, you were only allowed to check one box. I mean, you could check Hispanic and then one race, but you're only allowed to check one racial box. In 1997, OMB changed the rules under pressure from multiracial activists. They wanted a separate multiracial classification. All the civil rights groups were against that. They didn't want to decrease their numbers in the census for various reasons. They thought it would reduce their political power, essentially. So instead of creating a new multiracial classification, you are permitted to check that you are of more than one race. So you could check Hispanic. So theoretically, at least, someone could be, depending on their origins, Hispanic first, and they could be all of the above for race, or they could just be some of those. So that's what we are left with. And when you say how are they used, they're used for affirmative action purposes, they're used for civil rights enforcement, they're used on the census, or the census does ask about subclassifications like for Asians and Hispanics, which are not usually asked about for affirmative action purposes. They are used bizarrely for medical research. The government created rules. Congress created a law in the late 1990s requiring NIH, National Institutes of Health, and FDA to ensure that there's enough racial diversity within their or ethnic diversity within the subjects of medical studies. And FDA and NIH, scientifically speaking, should have gotten some elite panel together and said, okay, we need to, by congressional edict, decide what sort of classifications would make sense for scientific purposes. And that could be based on genetic differences. It could be based on sociological differences for studies of who gets heart attacks and why, based on lifestyle. But you know, I sympathize with, or empathize with them. If I'm the head of NIH, or the head of FDA in like 2002, and I have to make these rules, am I going to call an expert panel together to decide what race means in the medical context and just have everyone in the world come down on me for, you know, pretending that race is scientific? But Congress has made me do this. So what do? Well, I just take the classifications that we're using for everything else, which, by the way, when OMB published them in the Federal Register, said, by the way, these aren't anthropological classifications. They aren't scientific classifications. Don't use them for that. And we now use them for scientific purposes. So it's completely insane. We have these scientific studies that say, for example, here's what we discovered about the Asian population from this scientific study. But this Asian population is genetically incredibly varied. Pakistan, it could be 100% Pakistani Americans or Indian Americans, could be 100% Filipinos, could be 100% Chinese Americans or any combination, and you have no idea. So you're learning nothing useful from seeing that. So this is true of Asians. Does that mean if an Indian American comes into my office and I'm a doctor, I should be concerned about something? Well, you don't know, because you don't even know which Asian group the study was done on. Same thing with Hispanics. Hispanics, like we said, can be of any race. The average American Hispanic is about 55% European genetically, about 30-something percent indigenous, and about 10% or so African descent. So basically, it doesn't mean anything. It's like saying you're American. You have no idea what ethnic origin anyone is, and you have no idea when they study Hispanics what the genetic origin of that particular Hispanic population. Maybe there's only 300 people in the study. They could be mostly Cuban Americans or primarily Caucasian. They could be mostly Dominican Americans or primarily African. They could be some group in New Mexico who is mostly indigenous. You have no idea. So it's complete garbage. And it's shocking to me, really shocking. It's the most shocking thing in my book, that we use garbage, pseudo-racial, pseudo-scientific, nonsensical statistics for any given purpose, and we use it all the time, and it's become widely accepted in the scientific community, which 20 years ago said, this is crazy, why are we doing this? But, oh, don't worry about it, everyone said 20 years ago. In 20 years, we'll be using genetics instead. And we're not. We're still using this nonsense.
That's an interesting set of conversations on sort of the way it's continued to be used, the way we've sort of had categories that have continued through time. And I'd love to get a little later into the sort of effects that have been had, the possible, now that we are 20 years, 30 years, however many years in, what possible improvements could be made or how it's done really well and as we've used this system. But before we get there, I would love to know, just as we're rounding out the set of facts of this system, how it works, who collects and reports the data? I think you've mentioned the census and individual employers and perhaps schools, but how does this data about people get collected?
Primarily, you are asked to voluntarily give this data when you apply for a mortgage or when you apply for college or when you matriculate at college or when you're signed up for a medical study. We've all checked these boxes at various times in our lives. Now, I should say, while it is voluntary, first of all, you're not always told it's voluntary. So if you look at the Common App, while it is voluntary, you don't have to fill it out. It doesn't say you don't have to fill it out. So people kind of think you do. Only like 1.5%, I think I saw was a statistic, of students who apply to college do not check it. The second thing that is a little disturbing to me, at least, and troubling, is there are certain government regulations that require that if you don't fill it out, that someone has to guess. So for example, if you apply for a mortgage and you decline to fill out what your race is, the mortgage loan officer has to guess. Now, in the old days, when you apply for mortgages in person, they would just look at you or look at your last name and decide. Now, everyone does everything online. I don't even know what – I guess they just look at your last name and zip code and whatever guess they make. They likely – I don't know what they do really. They do just guess, but it's – and same is true in some employment contexts that people don't say that you have to guess. So even if you really want to opt out of the system entirely, you're not allowed to. In fact, I discovered reading – some of the underlying litigation documents in the Harvard affirmative action case. At Harvard, I'm sure they don't do this in every case, but if you would not check the box and Harvard thought maybe we could claim you for affirmative action, they would investigate your background. They would look at your social media posts. They would look at your zip code. They would look at your demographics of your high school to try to figure out, is this person, say, black, so we can claim them. So that also troubles me. So in other words, if you were someone who was African-American, you didn't want to get a preference. You didn't want Harvard to know you were black. You wanted to play the game completely straight and not be considered based on your race. Harvard would still try to put you into one of those boxes so they could claim you really against your will, against your consent. So, I mean, it does seem to me that I would be in favor of some sort of racial privacy law, right? That if you decline to state your race, that no one should be permitted, certainly the government shouldn't be permitted to identify you by race against your will, but we don't have any such thing in the United States.
That's, wow, I had not heard about that, but it is interesting to see sort of the various ways that this data can be collected or asserted, as the case may be. As mentioned earlier, I would love to turn to sort of the ways the system has worked, because we mentioned earlier in the podcast, sort of at the beginning, like, here are the goals we had for being able to classify race and ethnicity. And so how is it done? Do these categories, are they helpful in delineating our current racial and ethnic makeup in the U.S. In ways that are helpful from a regulatory standpoint, even if they might not be in some of the other ways, say medicine, that they've been picked up? What's the current status quo?
Sure. Well, back in the 1970s, when these statistics were created, at least classifications were created. So go back to the 1970 census, the most recent census. At the time, about, I think it was 12% of the population was African-American. About 82% or so, or 81% was non-Hispanic white. About 5% were Hispanics, what we now call Hispanics, but there's no such classification yet, but were of Spanish-speaking origin. But though such individuals at the time were generally considered to be white ethnics. The history of the of Spanish people of Spanish-speaking origin is while in border towns and in places where there were a large congregation of Mexican-American immigrants, they were generally often considered to be a minority racial group. As far as the U.S. government was concerned, if you were of Spanish-speaking origin, unless you were obviously of African origin, you were white. And then there was less than 1% of people who checked that they were of Asian American or Native American origin. So at the time, and also interracial marriage was pretty rare and still pretty much frowned upon by most people. So if you're making these classifications in 1977, you're thinking, well, basically we have a black and white society. And given the one drop rule of the idea that if you have discernible African American ancestry, that you're African American, this isn't going to cause a lot of problems. And this is primarily going to be for enforcing civil rights legislation, and it's mostly for African Americans. And also, if you're Hispanic, we don't really care. You know, if your last name is Rodriguez or Lopez or something like that, even if you're blonde hair and blue eyed, when you send in your resume, someone's not going to know you're blonde hair and blue eyed, so they'll probably discriminate against you anyway. For those limited purposes, they were far from ideal. It still certainly didn't make any sense to put like Indian Americans and Filipino Americans in the same classification. But you know, and broadly speaking, they were probably good enough for government work, as they say. Now we go ahead 36 years, and we've had tremendous immigration from Latin America, tremendous immigration from Asia. We have in the African American community, I didn't even know this till I wrote the book, 21% of African Americans in the United States are either first or second generation immigrants. We have much higher rates of interracial marriage than we used to, and a lot more people who have mixed origins. So we have a lot of people, my grandfather was Mexican, or my great-grandmother was a Navajo, and these classifications have become really imprecise and really poorly suited. We talked about medicine already, but even for affirmative action, poorly suited. I always tell people when I give talks about this that if you're in favor of affirmative action, you should be troubled by the way the classifications are used. Because putting aside universities are already problematic, because again, blonde hair, blue eyed person whose parents immigrated from Spain 15 years ago gets a preference. But even more so, the area of affirmative action which gets less attention is government contracting. A lot of people think that government contracting doesn't have affirmative action anymore because didn't the Supreme Court say that was unconstitutional? Well, they left some loopholes, and those loopholes turned out to be big enough to drive a truck through, and there's more racial preferences in government contracting than there ever has been before. And the way government contracting works is that if you are a member of any of the designated minority groups, you get exactly the same preference. It's not like universities where African Americans get the biggest preference and Hispanics get somewhat less, and Asians probably face discrimination. If you're in whatever group you're in, you get a preference. So already about half of Americans can non-fraudulently claim to be a member of one of these groups, right? Because again, even if you don't go around in life thinking to yourself, oh, I'm Hispanic or whatever, if you have a Mexican-American grandparent or great-grandparent, you could check the box and say, I identify as such. Who's going to say that it's not true? So blacks are about 14% of the population. Hispanics are about 19%. Asian Americans are about 7%. Native Americans are about 1%. So we're already over 40%. And those are the people who check the boxes on the census. Then you can not check the box in the census, but you still, yeah, why not? I'm applying and my great-great-grandmother is whatever, Hispanic. I'll just check the box. So already we're about 50%. In another generation, we'll probably be more like 80%. If 80% of Americans are getting preferences, then really no one's getting a preference. So affirmative, the whole thing becomes moot, really. So if you really think that there are certain groups because of historical discrimination or present-day discrimination or whatever the rationale is, and you want to give them a preference to help them break into the economic mainstream, that's not what we're doing anymore. Even at universities, which, again, do differentiate more, over 40% of African-Americans who are getting into Ivy League and other elite schools and are getting affirmative action preferences are first or second generation African or Caribbean immigrants or have mixed race parents. These are not the sort of people, you know, when we think of affirmative action, we think, oh, we want someone whose ancestors struggled through slavery and Jim Crow and wound up in a inner city school or a rural school underfunded to get that break. That's not who these preferences are primarily going to. It's a lot of them are going to, again, immigrants and mixed-race individuals, and also most of them are from relatively high-income households, even if they are people whose ancestors were American slaves. The Hispanic classification, I don't think anyone's done a study on this, but I think it's fair to say that a lot of people who are getting Hispanic preferences are not like people who are suffering from race discrimination because they're Hispanic, but are people who happen to have some Spanish-speaking origins, but are not necessarily different demographically otherwise than the mainstream individuals who are getting into these colleges. So they're not my suspicion is, I mean, my hypothesis is, having written about this and talked to people and given speeches, that people on the left who are skeptical, very favorably inclined to affirmative action, they are also uncomfortable with what's happened to the classifications. And they're also uncomfortable with the fact that diversity is the primary rationale rather than trying to make up for past discrimination. But the problem is they understand also that affirmative action has been under legal and political threat. It's never been popular. It's constitutionality has always been in question, and they're afraid, I think, if they publicly question the classifications, they're just giving ammunition to the other side. So we're thinking a little bit of help for the groups who really want to help us better than nothing, and it's symbolically important as well. So they haven't sort of jumped on the bandwagon. But one of the surprises when I was writing my book Classified was it turned out that I thought that when I wrote the book, that people on the left were going to really hammer me on it. But it turns out that just when I was writing the book, all of a sudden it became very controversial in sort of circles on the left. Why are we including white Hispanic people in affirmative action? Why do we call people a people of color? What do all these groups have in common? Shouldn't we be privileging the stories of African Americans and Native Americans who live on reservations? And we have this new BIPOC, Black Indigenous people and people of color, which focuses on them. We talk about anti-blackness instead of just racism in general. We talk about ADOS, American descent of slaves, to separate them out from from recent immigrants. So there's actually some ferment on this, not in the affirmative action context so much, but just on the side of, aren't we losing our focus here? We were really worried primarily about groups that really faced centuries of historical violence and discrimination in the U.S., and people of color and all that doesn't really capture that the way we want to. Sorry, that was really long.
Got it. It ties into my last two questions, the first of which, both of which turn to the future, and the first of which ties into that BIPOC and the categories you mentioned. What proposed amendments or new categories have there been for ways to update this system?
So there have been a lot of comments to OMB because they are reconsidering, saying we should do something about separating out subgroups of African Americans. As far as I know, OMB is not formally considering that, but there's been a lot of organizations, individuals who've been advocating that. Asian American groups have been advocating that, like as the census itself does, that more generally these statistics should be broken down, because the concern for Asian American groups, the Asian American groups, not surprisingly, want to keep the classifications because their political power comes from the idea that there's this group of Asian Americans, which, by the way, only about 40% of Asian Americans accept being called Asian Americans. So the majority of Asian Americans say, don't call me that, I'm Chinese American or just American, but I don't have anything in common with, other people from other parts of Asia, just because we're for the same very broad geographic reason. But in any event, Asian American groups, which accept the classification, say, wait a second, we're considered the model minority, and people say that Asians don't need any help and maybe even should be subject to discrimination in admissions because they're quote-unquote overrepresented. But it turns out, they don't say this explicitly, but I'll say it explicitly, that the groups that, when you say Asian Americans are overrepresented, you're primarily talking about Chinese and Indian Americans. Those are the groups, if you go onto a college campus, you say, which are the Asian groups that are quote-unquote overrepresented, a term that I don't like, it would be those two groups. And there's Japanese and Korean Americans too, but they're much smaller groups, and they're not as educationally successful or successful in government contracting as those two. But then you have other subgroups like Vietnamese Americans and Malaysian Americans and Filipino Americans and Pakistani Americans whose socioeconomic indicators on average are around the median, lower than the median, slightly higher than the median, but in other words, are not overachieving the way the other groups are. And whatever struggles they might be, Cambodians, Hmong, and so forth, whatever struggles they're having gets subsumed into this artificial Asian American classification. So they want to break this down by subgroups. I think you should get rid of that nonsense classification entirely, but they don't want to do that, but they do want the subgroups to be considered. So that, again, I haven't heard that OMB is formally considering that, but there has been agitation to do that. The two things that OMB is formally considering doing is, first of all, creating a new Middle East and North African classification that they're officially considering making it a racial one. It could also be an ethnic classification like Hispanic. Neither of those make any sense to me. Really, there are two things that this classification is trying to get at. The first is Arab American groups would like a classification, but there aren't really that many Arab Americans in the United States. Something like 3 million. So it's really hard to persuade the government that we should make a separate classification. Right now, Arab Americans, by the way, are classified as white. And the Arab American population itself is divided maybe 50-50 between Lebanese Americans, who are mostly Christian and have been and mostly been in the East for a long time, and more recent immigrants who are mostly Muslim from other parts of the Arab world. So in any event, the mullah would capture them. Similarly, there's a view among Muslim American activists that Muslim Americans have been racialized. You can't have a Muslim American classification. We have a long prior tradition in the United States of not classifying people by religion because of the Establishment Clause. Now, so the problem is that if you look at the groups that are subsumed under MENA, first of all, a lot of them aren't Muslim. So it doesn't really capture that Muslim thing. We have 500,000 or so Chaldean Americans, mostly living in Michigan from Iraq, who are Christian. We have Israeli Americans, several hundred thousand of those who would be in that classification, who are mostly Jewish. We have Coptic Christians from Egypt. We have Druze. We have we have Armenians, I think, would come within, who again are Christian. So the MENA thing doesn't really capture what's going on with Muslims. It also doesn't capture what's going on with Arabs. I think Chaldean Americans might not consider themselves Arabs. If you say we're talking about people from Arab countries, well, then we still have Turks and Iranians and Israelis and Armenians and Afghans, all of whom are not Arab Americans. So the MENA classification, rather than giving us additional insight by breaking out a coherent subgroup, is internally incoherent, just like the white classification itself is. So we're just piling garbage on top of garbage rather than trying to do something sensible. The other thing that is going on, and I really don't understand what the specific impetus for it is that Latino groups have changed their mind after opposing, for the most part, making Hispanic into a racial classification for most of the history of these classifications. They're now advocating changing it to a racial classification. And I think maybe, I guess part of the reason is because now you could check more than one race. Back in the day, the Civil Rights Coalition was very much against, besides Latinos not being in favor of it, besides us having a history of not considering Latinos to be a separate race, putting them within the white classification, if anything. Back in the day, Asian American groups were concerned, well, if we have a separate Hispanic racial classification, some Filipinos will check off Hispanic rather than Asian and will lose constituents. The African American groups were concerned that if we have a Hispanic racial classification, some people will check off Hispanic if they're Afro-Hispanics rather than African American, like people from Dominican Republic, and will lose constituents. The Native American groups were concerned that people of mixed ancestry will check off Hispanic, not Native American. With Hispanic, they can check off both. Now they can check off both anyway, so you don't have to worry about losing any constituents. But anyway, they're now advocating for that. And frankly, you know, whatever political objectives they have in mind in making Hispanic into a racial classification, it, for all the reasons we discussed earlier, doesn't really make any sense. I mean, no one really thinks that if you run into your blonde-haired, blue-eyed, German-descended, Argentine neighbor, that person is somehow from a different racial group than someone who's just German American who came directly to the United States. You're separating people out officially by ethnicity is problematic enough. One of my major concerns with these racial classifications, which we haven't mentioned, is that the government, by separating people into racial classifications, makes people more likely to think of themselves as being a member of that race as their identity. Some people think this is a benefit. Like, if you Google, this is shocking. This is the second most shocking thing to me after, well, the third, like, all right, the most shocking figure in my book was that we use these nonsense classifications in medicine. The second most shocking thing to me, which I really haven't mentioned, is that Native Americans sometimes are given benefits based on their blood quantum, like how much descent Indian they are, and that the Bureau of Indian American Affairs will issue you a certificate that says you are 1/4 blood quantum Indian or 1/2 or 100%, which so much reminds me of Nazi racial laws that it just makes my mind hurt. My brain hurts. The third most shocking thing, though, is that when it comes to that if you Google the phrase white racial consciousness, which I came across as I was finishing my book, and I was Googling, I thought, oh, what is this white racial consciousness? It sounds like David Duke or Nick Fuentes, like white nationalist, racist, neo-Nazi types. It turns out that this phrase has been adopted by left-wing sociologists, anthropologists, and so forth, as a positive good, that whites should have racial consciousness. Why do we want whites to have racial consciousness? Well, because until they recognize that how their whiteness and their intrinsic whiteness and how they have white privilege, they won't recognize that white privilege, and therefore they won't become woke and become allies in overcoming America's racism. Now, I understand, sociologically speaking, why they adopt this position, because in sociology departments and anthropology departments and so forth, the people who have white racial consciousness probably are indeed woke people who say, I have white privilege and therefore I want to help overcome racism. However, in practice, my intuition was that encouraging people to think of themselves as primarily being white, as opposed to other identities they may have, be it a religious identity, an ethnic identity, being gamers, being musicians, being whatever, being their professions, that this is likely to, increasing white racial consciousness is likely to increase racism. Why? Because human psychology, human nature, human history is such that when people adopt an in-group mentality, they don't normally say, oh, I'm a member of the in-group, and because I'm a member of this in-group, I want to help the people in the out-group. That is not the way things generally work. The way things generally work is, I'm a member of this in-group, so I'm a member of this in-group. I want to help my in-group at the expense, if necessary, of the out-group, right? This is like every ethnocentric, racist, racialist, religious chauvinist movement ever in human history. So that was my intuition, and I actually looked it up, and it turns out there are studies about this. And to really, should be no one's surprise, the more people think of themselves as having a white identity, the more likely they are to be racist. So making a new racial group. So to me, what we should be doing is breaking down these racial groups. If we have to classify people for statistical reasons, for other reasons, for medical reasons, we should break it down to the narrowest, like, ethnic sort of group possible. So shouldn't talk about Asian Americans, show your Chinese ethnicity or half Chinese, half Korean, whatever, half Chinese, half English, wherever you happen to be. You're African American, that should be a separate potential ethnic identity, but we can all say that overall our primary identity as far as what we think of ourselves in a group way beyond, you know, our professional religious, we're all Americans, right? We understand the melting pot or even the tossed salad theory, but we're all Americans. But once we say, oh no, we're white, we're Asian, we're now Hispanic racially, whatever it may be, the more we define ourselves that way permanently, the more likely we are to run into trouble in the future where people say, well, you know, how dare you be a white nationalist? And I of course find that objectionable, but if when that person says, wait a second, from the time I was 2 years old, you told me how I'm white and I have white privilege and I should think of myself as white and I should be hyper aware of my whiteness and other people's lack of whiteness, then why should I, as a white person, spend my time worrying about other people who aren't white? So no, we don't want that. We want, like, oh no, I am an American who happens to be of whatever ethnic origins I have, and that may have medical consequences based on my genetics, that may have sociological consequences that we want to study, that may have, there may be particular groups who are sufficiently struggling that we want to help them as fellow Americans, but to permanently divide Americans by race is extremely dangerous. Now, again, these people on the left, their view is America it has been so racist and racist so embedded in America that we're never going to get to that point where we just think of ourselves as all just being Americans. So we should institutionalize this and then make sure each group's getting its fair share. And again, I think that's dangerous. I also think it's pessimistic. I think that there's no, and we all acknowledge, I mean, I should say we all, but they and we would agree, we being me, that race is socially constructed, that race, there are genetic differences, you know, across populations, but they're not coextensive with race, and there are often just as many differences within a racial group as between groups. Okay, once we have that, once we acknowledge that's true, then it's just sociology and history and so forth. So why can't we get past that? They'll say, this is so embedded in America, we'll never get past it. I say, you know, in 1960, when John F. Kennedy ran for president, people were very dubious that we elect a Catholic president. This Catholic Protestant divide was so embedded in American history. I mean, the Ku Klux Klan was the largest political organization in the United States in the 1920s, and it was primarily anti-Catholic. That was less than 40 years before 1960. And in fact, Kennedy lost the vote of millions of Protestants who normally voted Democrat, who wouldn't vote for a Catholic. And he won because millions of Catholics who normally voted a Republican voted for him out of identity politics. We don't think of Catholics engaging in identity politics anymore, but they did at the time because they were then a minority group that was distinct. Fast forward 60 years, Joe Biden becomes president. He's Catholic. No one talks about it. No one goes, like, I mean, you know, it's mentioned about it. No one cares. Speaker of the House, Catholic, Nancy Pelosi. Chuck Schumer, Senate Majority Leader, Jewish. 9 justices on the Supreme Court, 6 Catholics, 2 Jews. No one cares. Vice President, mixed race on one side, Indian, Asian Indian on the other, identifies as black, not a big deal. If you had told people in 1960 that that would be the American government 60 years later, they would have said, you know, I say this only half jokingly, you're letting the Catholics and the Jews run the government with Negroes, you know, in the, like, what? That, you know, it was completely, you know, it would have been inconceivable to them. Because to them, America, you know, to the average American in 1960, the U.S. was a white Protestant country with a big Catholic minority, a smaller Jewish minority, and a black minority that wasn't really considered part of the, you know, full polity. And the idea of that those people would be, of which I'm one, are running the government, you know, 60 years later would have been impossible. So if that could change that dramatically in 60 years, there's no reason that 60 years from now, with all the intermarriage and immigration and Americans being, you know, incredibly tolerant relative to most countries on race and compared to our past, I always tell people, you know, 1958, 4% of Americans, one digit, supported, thought interracial marriage was acceptable. Now it's 95%. And among people 30 and under, it's 98%. That's the joke. Why can't 60 years from now we have a common American multiracial identity? And there's no reason we can't, but you know what? If the government continues to classify people by race, by crude racial categories, and continues to encourage people along with the encouragement of the establishment, the big corporations, the universities, the government, the entertainment industry, they're all bought in to these classifications, that will stop us. That could really be the barrier.
We can wrap it there. Professor Bernstein, thank you so much for being with us today and sharing your expertise and insight. We really appreciate you taking the time. It's been a great discussion.
Thank you very much.
On behalf of the Federal Society's Regulatory Transparency Project, thanks for tuning in to the Fourth Branch Podcast. To catch every new episode when it's released, you can subscribe on Apple Podcasts, Google Play, and Spreaker. For the latest from RTP, please visit our website at regproject.org. That's regproject.org.
This has been a FedSoc audio production.